With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, you're listening to The Legacy Tapes. I'm Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and this is a series of conversations exploring how to leave something lasting in the ephemeral medium of theatre. And I'm here talking to John McGrath, the brilliant artistic director at Manchester International Festival. Before that, he was artistic director at National Theatre of Wales. And before that, he was at Contact in Manchester, where he came up with all sorts of innovations around youth governance and brilliant world-changing things. So the thing that I thought would be a good thing to talk about was kind of the time at NTW and starting something that feels like it needs a legacy.
Mm.
Was that the most incredibly pressured thing ever to have in your on your shoulders?
Well, I think it's really interesting frame for this conversation, isn't it, between the sort of ephemeral nature of theatre and the legacy of an organisation.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think it's the ephemeral nature of theatre that saves us in these situations, because what we're used to is just making something happen. And if it isn't right, we'll give it another go and we'll do better next time.
And with any luck, something will have forgotten it.
Exactly. So coming into something like setting up a national theatre, in a way, you come with that theatrical energy of let's just do it. Let's just make things happen. But again, I think particularly with something as weighty a name as a national theatre, you are aware of all that other stuff, so you're balancing those two energies. And I think that for me, one of the important decisions with NTW was that we should try and not get caught up in first show energy and first show judgment. Mm-hmm. And so we needed to think about an opening statement that addressed that set the company in place in a way that made sense. And so the initial programme for National Theatre Wales was announced as a year-long programme, 12 shows in 12 months. We actually did 13 in the end, each in a different place in Wales and each using a different approach to theatre making. And that set out a stall in a way that allowed maybe the idea to be bigger than any of the individual parts. Although, of course, our 13th show, Passion, with Michael Sheen, ended up being so big that in some ways it came to stand for everything. But I think that the basic thought that we needed to place this in the country in a way that would continue to make sense beyond any of the individual shows was an important part of that. And in some ways, that programme of work came to define the company and what it was, perhaps more than we'd expected. I'd initially thought maybe in the second year we'll focus on touring work, but actually, by the end of that year, it became apparent that actually the question wasn't, oh, what model shall we use next, but what do we do next with this model?
Okay. And so that feels like you were shooting. Like the idea of legacy and the idea of kind of a sustained, deeper meaning was part of the very, very start. That was the first thing you were thinking about.
I think because of that name and because of that status and because of that sense that this isn't what shall we do, but what shall we do for this bigger and as part of this bigger idea.
For this nation.
Yeah, for this nation. Now, I never thought I'd run something called a national theatre. I am a dyed-in-the-wool internationalist.
Yeah.
And but when I was offered the opportunity, it was a time, early 2000s, 2008 when I was offered it, where the idea of nation, as it does today in Europe in particular, and what that meant felt very politically significant. Whatever, even if you didn't place yourself with any in a conventional relationship, to that, it felt very significant. So I was also very interested in how do we even explore what that word means through what this theatre becomes. And really early on, came up with I think a paradigm that became and continues to be very significant, which is that I suggested talking to people and thinking about things that maybe, and simplifying things as you do and as we do in theatre to have something to hold on to, that maybe there were three different ways to think about nation for a national theatre. Mm-hmm. One would be perhaps the most conservative, the most old school would be to think of it through history. You know, what's the canon? How do we get the canon onto stage? What does it say about the history of this nation, etc.? Mm-hmm. Another one that maybe might be more expected in a contemporary sense would be to think through a prism of identity. Mm-hmm. You know, what does this thing, this nation, this Welshness mean? Yeah. You know, so far more contemporary in its concerns and yet focused on the question of identity. And yet both of those seem to potentially be very excluding in their energy. Both also relied really on a dynamic of the being others that were not of this identity or not of this history.
Yeah.
And it felt that there was a third possibility in there, and one that was intrinsically theatrical, and that was to think of nation through place and to ask the question, what is it to be in this place? Mm. And the people then, for whom nation becomes relevant, become the people who are in this place. And I've subsequently sometimes use the example of the Scottish referendum, where everybody who lived in Scotland, whether they were a recent Polish immigrant or person of Pakistani heritage in Glasgow, or someone who could trace their heritage back through hundreds of years, everybody got to vote. Mm. What is it to be in this place, and what do we want this place to be? And people who lived elsewhere, whatever their heritage might be, didn't get to vote in that referendum. And I think in a strange way, we were doing an equivalent thing with the paradigm for National Theatre Welsh, which was to ask theatrically, what is it to be in this place? But when you ask that question theatrically, you don't just ask it, or maybe you don't even predominantly ask it in terms of the national accumulation that you get in a referendum. You ask it in a series of specifics. Mm-hmm. And so again, our initial year of work, our Theatre Map of Wales, as we became to call
specifics.
It, became 13 mm-hmm. specifics, which also became each ways of answering the bigger question or asking the bigger question as well. So that question of a place became very important and very defining as a way to address this question of nation in a way that felt dynamic and open, and also in a way that felt so appropriate to what theatre does, which is gather a group of people together uniquely in a moment and say, what are we in this theatre, in this space together?
Who are we here and now?
Who are we here and now? Here now together is sometimes how I've phrased it.
Yeah. And that's a really, it's a beautiful way to think about things, and quite stealthily political, that sense of anyone that's here now is us.
Yeah.
And that's, for the benefit of the recording, we're talking on the Monday after the European referendum result. And that's quite an unusual way of thinking about nationhood, actually, in terms of the cultural mainstream. So how is it different here at Manchester? Is there a different, there must be a different pressure and a different set of concerns and a different ideology around what the thing will be?
I mean, I've had, with those three main projects in a way, contact, National Theatre Wales and Manchester International Festival, come in to very different circumstances in each case. So Contact was an organisation with a long history, but that had gone into a hiatus, closed down during a building project and a project and needed completely reimagining. Mm. And we reimagined that through really focusing on the question of what would it be to put young people and emerging artists at the heart of a theatre organisation in a way that back then in 1999 just wasn't happening.
And even now is still a deeply political innovative choice.
And I think the great thing, thinking about legacy, the great thing coming back to Manchester is that, yes, Contact's been on many journeys in the intervening years and has changed and developed as it absolutely should. I'd be horrified to come back and find it exactly the same. And yet those core principles have only grown and continue to define the work and the ways in which young people and young artists are part of deciding what happens in that organisation continue to feel radical. Mm. With National Theatre Wales, the opportunity was to start something completely from scratch. So there was maybe decades, if not centuries, of discussion and debate, but no thing. Yeah. So that was a very open field to be in. And imagine international festival, the fascinating thing is to step into something that is incredibly successful.
Mm.
And go, well, actually, you know, how do we value everything that's really great about this thing while also going on a journey? Yeah. Because that's our job, is to continue on a journey, not to tick along.
Yeah.
And that's been fascinating for me to explore with staff, board, local people who feel included, people who don't feel included, what's great about this, what do we hold on to, what is its core identity, and also what journey can we take it on, what are the aspirations for it that are the potential for the future.
So that's interesting, because one of the things that I was going to ask in terms of legacy was how you balance or how you prioritise innovation versus stability. And could you talk about it? It sounds like those things sort of have to be moshed up together, but would you talk about it?
Yeah, and you know, I think that you know, if you see a dichotomy, question it is probably one good thing, one good approach. So if the dichotomy feels like it's between stability and what was the other word that you used?
I use innovation.
Innovation, then you know, then dig into that. You know, sometimes people used to use the phrase, oh, it's not revolution, it's evolution, isn't it? Which usually heralded absolutely nothing changing. So for me, it's about getting into the DNA, I guess. Mm-hmm. Saying, what is this thing? What's unique and most valuable about what we have here? That's the legacy, isn't it? Yeah. What's the DNA? And then how do we use that DNA to create the unexpected? So dig into the heart and out of that, create the unexpected, respond in new ways. And that's the journey that I'm on with the festival. I think there's also in terms of leadership, there can be sometimes a pressure, I guess, people coming into organisations, first of all, to say all the things they're supposed to say, you know, so happy to be taking on this world leading organisation, and then a few months after that to go, and now for a whole new start. And I'm not a big fan of that kind of, you know, sort of egotistical in a way. I think often that isn't an egotistical that's coming from within the person, but something that's almost pushed upon them. You know, how are you going to make your mark, etc.? I'm not a big fan of that. So for me, I'm very happy with the festival to say, you know, going into the next festival, it's going to be 18 days of wonderful new work as it's been in the past. Mm-hmm. And that's my main message. And I think that's what people want to hear. But then within that, the question becomes, well, what is that wonderful work and who does it reach and who makes it and how can we widen that and, as I say, continue to use that DNA that's all about being questioning and being ambitious and get it to take us to a new chapter and a new stage. So that's I guess my relationship to legacy in this case actually is finding out, well, what is the true legacy or what is this, you know, these core elements of this festival and how do we go on a journey with them?
Great. And I think one of my questions was going to be, what do you think your legacy has been and what do you hope it will be here? And then probably going way into the future, at the end of your time. On Earth, what would you like to have left changed?
Right. Well, starting with the shorter term, I mean, it's very interesting for me to come back to Manchester, and that's an unexpected and delightful bit of the journey because, of course, I sort of meet myself coming round now and, you know, come to a city working on a very high profile, very outward-facing project, but still with a very strong connection to something like Contact that was, you know, much more underground and street level in its reputations mm-hmm. and impacts. And one glorious thing over, I hope the next, you know, couple of festivals will be to see, you know, artists who I started on that journey with back in 1999 coming through to be, you know, people who are in and making work in this festival. And so it is an opportunity to be in touch with legacy in that way. But I think that for me, often the most joyful things have been when people have reappeared on the journey that, you know, you were able to have some impact or supportive relationship along the way, and then they yeah. reappear in new guises. Something that Contact put very... well, actually, the Contact put very deep in me, I was going to say, but actually it was there before because of the way that I was treated before, was the importance of informal networks of mentoring and support in the development of artists, particularly in this slightly sometimes rickety world of theatre.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky when I was 25, I got to go and study in New York. Mm. And ended up staying there for the best part of a decade. And the reason that I stayed there is, to me, that's sort of where I found my artistic family. And it was in downtown New York at a time when there were brilliant things still going on, but there were also, you know, actually it was a daily struggle to survive. And what amazed and delighted me always was the kind of cross-generational support that went on and the ways in which you would get adopted by mad theatre companies yeah. and in some ways, you know, abused to work for free on projects, but also given extraordinary artistic guidance. And so that to me, you know, Contact in a way was almost a kind of mini New York, and people would often, whenever people would walk in there from New York, they'd go, wow, this feels like home, and but it was about creating an informal environment, not always a structured environment yeah. within which those kinds of crossovers and support would happen, whether they were, you know, across age levels or just experience levels. There was loads of peer support that happened at Contact. And then at NTW, it became very important to me after that first year, actually one of the most important next steps was the work that we started to build in behind that around artist development. We had a big residency program across Wales called Wales Lab, which was more for emerging artists who weren't necessarily going to be produced by NTW at that point, but they were developing their work in the same context.
Yeah, planting the seeds for the things.
Yeah, and planting the seeds in the right sort of ground as well. So rather than creating a studio program, it was a lab that could take place, you know, on beaches, on yeah. mountains, in village halls, etc. And here at MIF, I think that it is, you know, really important now to be thinking, what is the impact of this festival on the life and creativity of the city and the many layers of that, and the artists who live, work here. I've used one little phrase recently, is that I'd love that our goal in Manchester should be to be a net importer of artists and a net exporter of art, so that mm-hmm. more and more people are coming here because it's a great and supportive environment in which to make work, and that a lot of those support networks will be lateral. They're yeah. not all institutions, mm-hmm. you know, setting programs in place. They're about how people communicate with each mm-hmm. other, support each other, the networks that are in place, and how we seed those without trying to dominate them. And then how that work starts to support and grow and spread itself around the world. And I think that the festival will always be a kind of, you know, a bit of the iceberg that's above water yeah. with that, you know, the there will be work and artists coming through that absolutely have their position on world stages, and yet are also absolutely offered from this place. And I would hope, you know, not only emerging artists, but also, you know, artists who are at very confident points increasingly thinking of Manchester as a place where they can either be based or at least make a substantial amount of their work.
Yeah. I think that in terms of those kind of horizontal networks that you're talking about, the stuff of the, you know, the bits of the iceberg that are under the water, I think it's amazing how much of an impact even the tiniest connections within that can make.
Yeah.
You did a really important thing that you are totally unaware of in shaping how I am an artistic director, in that I came and saw you when you first came to NTW and you insisted on paying for my train ticket. And no one else had ever done that. And it actually made, that week, it made a bit of a difference. I was really pleased about it. And then that meant that when I went to become, you know, when I was an artistic director myself, was kind of supporting artists, that sense that nothing, no engagement with me should ever cost emotionally or financially, really, really shaped how I thought about what I did and how we operated as an organisation. And that was just a tiny little thing.
I think those little things are so important, and it's sort of getting the principles of them in place in a way, so as they become kind of second nature, and they become organisational second nature as well. And I think those are difficult shifts for organisations to make. Even with an organisation like Contact that we were starting, almost restarting from scratch after the hiatus, there's still things now that seem self-evident there about, say, how young people, no jobs are ever appointed there without young people having running an interview panel. And that's sort of really intrinsic there now. But at the time when we started doing it, there were so many nerves around it. On a completely different way, when we started the digital network at NTW, the online social network, the idea that anybody could post anything and that it wasn't... it wasn't curated and it wasn't... It was just really difficult for a lot of people to get their heads around, to the extent that a whole bunch of people posted on that didn't believe it was true. They thought that we were signing off on everything. And we never, I think in all the years of that network, once or twice, we've asked people to either put their real name, which is one of the rules of the network, or to take something down, because you can't post something that's... negative about someone if you're not willing to say who it is doing it.
Yeah, you have the courage of your conviction.
Exactly. But beyond, other than that, it's been completely open. After a year, we opened it up so any independent company could post their own show as an event. So there's some curation in the sense that certain things get highlighted, but completely open network in there. And another example for me of that kind of thing that became very important, again, you stumble across these things, is that I realised over the years at NTW that I really wanted to help the independent scene emerge, and it had been really quite in Cardiff after years, I think in the 70s, 80s, maybe even early 90s, when it'd been quite vibrant, but it had gotten really quiet. And it's, things like Wales Lab really helped with that, and the fact that we were just shining a light on the country, although most of our work wasn't in Cardiff at NTW, but how could we really push that across the nation, but inevitably, like any fringe scene, particularly in the bigger city. And I realised that one of the single best things that we could do was to just go and see the stuff that was on. And it would be great for us because we might find an artist, but actually just turning up was the most extraordinary thing. They had a dialogue. And if you're scrabbling together to do a fringe show for next to nothing, you're not doing it because you're expecting to make money, you're doing it because you're trying to start to make your mark. And if someone from your national theatre comes along, de facto, actually, it was worth it. And that sounds kind of arrogant on my side.
No,
but actually, then all those artists, they got seen, and that's what it was all about.
Yeah,
and
so, just being heard,
Yeah, and so we developed a policy called the Go See policy, which was that if you let us know more than a couple of weeks in advance that you had something on, someone from the company would come to see it. And, obviously, the scene could extend to a point where that became difficult. And as it grew, we had to pull in more people who were part of the team who were looking. But you build those structures. And certainly for me, I'd still try and, a couple of nights a week, get out and see stuff that, was on the fringe or in development. And, it was probably one of the most important things that we could do in terms of helping to make that independent scene happen.
And I guess that was a reciprocal legacy, right? Because that creates a legacy within the scene of a sense of dialogue with the National Theatre, but also it's going to change you in terms of hearing what the discourse is.
Well, you don't do, none of the, there's no unselfish act, you know, that every encounter is an opportunity for you to grow and experience new things. And so maintaining that sense of sort of hopeful generosity that you think, well, I'm going to keep trying to do these things and it will benefit. It will, and of course, it benefited the company in terms of how it's seen and how it's talked about within the country.
And the love of it.
Yeah.
Just sheer love of that.
Yeah.
Company.
Yeah. So, and it's those little things that make that difference. And of course, yes, you've got to do fantastic shows and every now and then have like a really big hit and all of that good stuff, but you can't just have that and still have that sense of buy-in and organic connection.
Okay, so there's a third bit of this question that you have.
When you die and they lay you to rest.
Yeah, which is, what's on your tombstone?
I suspect that when I die, the lifelong experience of being confused with the real John McGrath of 784 will just be permanently embedded in some weird mashed up Google profile that'll be a life of 120 years two very different but linked in some ways still quite linked approaches to theatre making. There'll be a very Manchester element of the story because of this in a way unexpected return. And I think the ways in which art and artists happen in Manchester will be a big part of my story. But hopefully that will always be seen as a thing that links internationally. I suspect I will be called Founding Artistic Director of National Theatre Wales. So that'll be a nice thing to have in there. I hope that that whatever end of life event happens, you know, that it will be a raucous, multi-generational and very culturally diverse event.
Right.
And that would represent the audiences and artists that hopefully I've been part of supporting, working with, being supported by over the years. And it would be theatrical in the most cross-art form of ways.
Right. Wow, that's a pretty awesome...
It's a good sending off, yeah?
Yeah. Just imagining that, it's almost worth dying. Almost.
If you could just be around to the party, that's the problem.
Exactly. I'm just talking to you, it's interesting because I'm aware that you have quite a deeply ethical strand to how you think about what theatre and the arts are, without being necessarily shouty crackers about it. That's just the bedrock of a lot of how you talk about work. Why do you do this? And B, do you think theatre or the arts changes the world in a tangible way or can? And I feel like somehow those are interlinked as questions.
I think theatre and the arts invents the world, you know, creates it. I think that, you know, the idea that there's some world over there and that those of us in the arts are sort of off in a corner commenting on it, you know, it completely bewilders me. I do come from that viewpoint that believes that everybody has culture because that's what makes us human. Mm-hmm. But there's a continual negotiation and struggle and investigation and invention as to what that will be. Mm-hmm. And there are ways in which the world locks it down and things become commodified. And commodification can be immensely attractive and appealing. It's all about, you know, pushing certain buttons and, you know, chemicals in our heads and bodies, mm-hmm. and going, oh yes, I need more of that. Mm-hmm. And so those who really dedicate themselves to the what of culture, to how it's going to be, you know, who we might call artists, are the ones that question that commodification, those sort of autopilot versions of mm-hmm. culture that somehow come into our lives and settle there in a overly determined way and shake it up and keep shaking it up. And that shaking up is not always comfortable to everybody, mm-hmm. but, you know, like any social shaking up as well, it means that, you know, the structures of who's got what change, and so yeah. it often can be most exhilarating for those who have least, in the sense that, you know, the change brings in the possibility of a different balance of opportunities and resources. So for me, that's what we do as artists, or as people for whom making art is central to our day to day, is that we're the shakers of the culture, but the culture is always there, and somebody else might intervene in it just for a day and do something radical and extraordinary, and we need to be alert and alive to that as well. In terms of the ethics of that, ethics in the widest and least judgmental sense of the word, again, is this incredibly exciting way that we're human, that we actually don't just care where we get our next meal from, but we care where other people get their next meal from. And that actually is this very human drive to engage with other people in a way that isn't purely selfish. And that's not something that we should do, and that ethical people tell us we should do. That's something that's very curiously present in us. And then again, you know, the way that the world structures itself, and the other sides of us, the survival sides, come in to limit that. And so we have this struggle between those two things all of the time. And so to me, that question of what is an ethics sits very close to that question of what is culture. You know, again, they're in that space that make humanity and the experience of being human actually interesting and exciting. They're not these slightly dreary things that we're trying to impose on the more enjoyable bits of life. They're the bits that actually make it exciting and enjoyable, and the impositions of the structures that limit that. So in that sense, for me, art and ethics sit very comfortably together. But in order for them to sit comfortably together, we've got to think about ethics in a completely different way to how that word gets boxed. It's absolutely all about how do we reopen up the excitement of our encounter with others, not how do we set a bunch of rules. So the kind of ethics that I'm interested in are never about we should do this or we should do that, or this person should do this or this person should do that. That's why I'm still quite a free speech, or in the States, a First Amendment kind of purist, actually. You know, what's not to be said if we can provide the right space to say it in? If it's there may be questions about what those spaces are, but our job as artists is to create spaces in which anything can happen, so as we can try things out, and then we get into both cultural and ethical potential, an exhilarating potential, because of what can happen.
Because it's only really when anything can be said and considered that you can be sure that the consensus is an educated right. Correct one.
Or even that we can feel our way in through it and into it, actually. I think it's not even that, you know, considered an end-oriented. Yeah, it's like, you know, we have to be in this so as we can know why does it exist in there. And then I think the question is, well, what in this is liberating and freeing and knocks away those conventionalized structures? And what actually reiterates them and solidifies them, and I believe when you ask those questions, certain things like, you know, dogmatic racism, etc., actually become very limiting for you. They become those stretches. You go, oh, those are things that by being there stop things happening, not things that free things up. But you've almost got to allow the spaces to try that out.
To figure it out.
To figure it out, and to figure it out very experientially, very existentially in a way.
Interesting. I like this vision of the world this complex vision of the world full of complex humans sort of managing the battling of the aspects of their own nature. That's maybe battling is too aggressive a word, but that...
Grappling, let's say.
Grappling, yeah. That's great. It's a nice way to think about the world. I'm going to be really simplistic for my last thing, because I feel like I've taken up quite a lot of your time now. If you could know that one thing would be changed, and you can change, it can be in the arts, it can be in the wider world, it can be in any category you choose, in a single person's mind, anything. If you could leave one thing changed with a magic wand, what would it be?
Who gets to be creative? The hardest lives are probably the ones in which all time, all energy gets filled, gets taken by things that are not yours to determine. And so when space begins to open up for you to be able to explore, play, invent, that's when life starts to open up, and I would love there to be a situation where no life didn't have that space, and that when that space does open up, it's not locked down and taken over immediately by a sort of rampant consumerist extraction, mm-hmm. You know, a rampant system that goes, oh, this is what we're gonna use that time to suck into this,
to
this market. Mm-hmm. So that would be the one thing that I'd like to see.
Yeah, I'm on board with that. I hope you get it.
I hope we all do.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.